I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the penultimate episode in this series of Your Own Personal Beatles. This is episode number 16, and I'm here as always with...
Robin Allender.
I think we're going to cut to the chase this week because it's a really long episode with Josh Widdicombe. There was so much good stuff in it, we didn't want to cut it down. We didn't really want to make it into a two-parter.
No.
So we'll just cut straight to the point this week. And,
yeah. You
know, what this is an episode re-recorded, couple of cans in hand with Josh a couple of weeks ago. And it's a fantastic one.
Yeah, he sort of didn't want to stop, which was great, you know.
It was just
lovely just to carry on. It was like having a chat down the pub, which is nice. There's one thing I wanted to clear up. I talked about Kate Bush quoting a bit from The Far Show.
Yeah.
And I just want to say, I don't know if she was consciously quoting from The Far Show or if she just came up with that off the top of her head. So I just wanted to clear that up.
Right, okay. Well, that's intriguing, knowing what you're talking about.
I don't know which is weirder, actually.
The latter, I think. Yeah. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Yeah, so look, watch out for that, peeps.
Yeah, and we'll be back at the end. And so enjoy this episode of Josh Widdicombe's Personal Beatles. So Robin and I are absolutely delighted this week to be joined by comedian and writer, the wonderful Josh Widdicombe. Hello, Josh. How are you
Hello.
Doing?
Hello. Very excited. I did say to you beforehand, but this is something I actually listened to, which is always a worry that this will go badly and I'll never be able to listen to it again. Very much like when I did badly on Richard Osman's House of Games.
I never really
could rewatch.
Oh, man.
fear of going back on the terrible answers I gave.
Didn't John absolutely rinse that one of you?
Almost certainly. He didn't have to go up against Steve Pemberton from The League of Gentlemen. That's all I've got to say.
Yeah, that's tough casting.
But we're not here to talk about that, I suppose.
No.
I listened to the Beatles today as if I was... But I felt like I should, as a kind of... The Ellis James episode, this isn't just going to be me going back over the episodes like a kind of fan, but... he kind of approached it like it was his Beatles exam. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And there was definitely that thing of you'd ask him a question and he'd go, well, what I wanted to talk about was like this B-side.
It was a bit like the vice presidential debate last night for the time of... recording.
Yeah,
he had really done his own, because we tried to set people at ease a bit before we record by saying that, you know, we're not looking for experts in any way and we really want it to be a personal emotional journey, and he was just like, all right, because he had been cramming facts.
He just wanted to get everything
in there. So it's about four episodes worth of stuff, so hopefully we'll get him back one day.
It was very entertaining, also, you did get the feeling he had notes.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a point where he left to apparently look after his child or something, but I think he's probably doing a bit of revision in the box.
He ended it by saying, in conclusion, the... how's your lockdown been, though, Josh? It's been fine
in terms of... I think it's... I pick my words carefully here, but like...
You've been enjoying it.
No. I don't know why everyone's complaining about it. Yeah. I think the first one felt a lot easier than what, at the time of recording, it feels like we're going back into or already into, in the sense of there felt like this kind of... You were living a moment of history and you were kind of part of it, and what you were doing was... brilliantly scientifically thought through by the scientists and the government, and it was going to work, and you were applauding for the NHS. And now I feel a bit like you haven't got that element. You've just got the ground down of the fact that you can't go to the pub.
Yeah.
Which I, yeah. But I know that's a very small complaint.
Yeah.
When they talk about the Blitz spirit, you do get the sense that they're sort of talking about the people in the first couple of months. And yeah. After a while, they're like, God, sleep in the fucking Northern Line again.
Totally. I think the Blitz spirit's probably overrated, isn't it? Having witnessed it now. I wonder if, you know, we're going to look back in a weird, like, in the same way, whether it'll be like, when we're old people, are we going to be talking about how the young people don't understand how great we all behaved during COVID and how everyone wore a mask?
I don't know. And have you been keeping busy, though? Have you, like, lots of podcasting and stuff? Have you?
Yeah, I think, you know, the mic I bought at the start of lockdown is probably the most used piece of equipment I've ever had in my career. I think that is a weird thing, and that's really what's really good for this is, like, is that podcast, which is obviously you know, it's the coming medium, for want of a, that's a terrible, what a wanky thing, but you know, it's like it feels like it's the start of something, whereas and it's still finding its way. And I think a lot of people, including myself, always thought you can't record a podcast if you're not all in the same room. How can you you know, how could you get that kind of that amazing electricity you get when you're interviewing someone in a tiny studio. But actually, the fact it's forced us to do this has meant that you can... It's totally fine. The technology's totally fine.
Yeah.
And I think it means that you could kind of do it from home, and it's great. I've really I've really enjoyed that freedom of going, I'm just going to go upstairs and talk about the Beatles for an hour.
It's basically what I do anyway.
There is that thing where I think the podcasts have done well in lockdown. Someone was saying this to me today, because you get that kind of screen fatigue. So you just, audio's kind of doing better at the moment. Kind of thing, you know,
I think that's definitely, I also think podcasts, you know, lockdown is by definition quite a lonely thing. Even if you're with other people, you're not seeing it. And podcast is the medium by far where you feel like you are most kind of being talked to by your friends. That's why I think, you know, you put it on when I put them on when I'm making dinner or whatever, or just while you're out walking around the house or whatever. And it feels like you're having interaction, even though you're not part of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's why people are so loyal and passionate about podcasts, whereas they're not, you can't stump, you make a choice. Look at your friends John Robbins and Ellis James, like their fans are so passionate. And I think that's partly the medium of podcasts itself, really.
Definitely. You're talking, you know, you're in someone's ear, like hours and hours of John's voice. Imagine that. That's great. So so you said you've listened to a few episodes. So what, how did you prepare for this?
Well, I've just stopped listening in preparation for this because I kind of didn't want to use other people's thoughts. That's a weird, like, I didn't want to it's more like if I'm doing something like a TV show where it's topical, I won't go on Twitter that week, for not because I'm worried I'll steal someone's joke, but I'm worried I'll see a joke that I've thought myself or something, and or it'll cramp the way you think. I just didn't want to kind of think about, I haven't really listened since I agreed to do this because I didn't want other people's thoughts about the Beatles in my head, if that makes sense.
I completely understand. When I used to review films and stuff, I could not read anyone else's opinion, no matter how small, about a film, because otherwise I would just... They would spot something I didn't spot, or I'd think about something in a different way, and then I'd feel like a fraud.
Totally.
I'm writing something at the moment, and... I watched something that was kind of on the same subject, and I couldn't relax at all for the comparisons in my head. I think, do I need to talk about that? Oh God, I've missed that. You know, but I can't say that now because you know. So it's once this is over, I can finally go back to listening to a podcast about the Beatles. What would be galling is were I to record this and then listen to a few in the next week, and they've all covered the exact same ground as me. And I'm aware that you guys have nodded on appreciatively, politely, knowing that. Just repeating stuff.
We'll have to have a sort of cliche klaxon if we get to a second and third series. start with the beginning of your sort of Beatles journey?
Can I open my beer? What for please that do. Question?
Sure.
Satisfying sound effect. Yes, that's a really good one. Like,
yeah, that was. I've not got a beer. I've got one of those sound effects CDs that they have at Radio 4.
Yeah, George Martin style. Yeah, yeah,
the Archers. Exactly. Yeah. Delicious beer.
I'll just walk across the gravel and tell you about the Beatles. So, where did it start?
What's your first memory of the Beatles, really?
I think I always knew that they were around because you do, because it's, you know, part of the common discussion, isn't it? It's like a reference that is kind of eternal. And my dad is, so my dad was born in 1960, so he would have been, 1950, sorry, 1950. Mm. So which is probably the perfect year to be born if you want to be a fan of the Beatles. So he was 12, 13, when, probably 12, because he was, when Please Please Me came out. Mm. 20 when it all ended.
Yeah. That's pretty perfect.
The dream period.
Yeah.
So he hit the Beatles like absolutely just right.
Yeah.
And so he had his record collection that was all like 60s stuff. He was a big Stones fan. Mm. So the Stones were more of a thing in my household than the Beatles. He was more of a Stones fan. Mm. And we used to go on family trips to see the Rolling Stones whenever they tour.
Really?
Yeah. So wow. The first gig I ever went to was when I was seven, and we went to see the Rolling Stones at Wembley on the Urban Jungle Tour, which was promoting album Steel Wheels.
Right, right.
Supported by Gunn. I don't know if you remember Gunn.
Oh, yeah.
And who did a cover of Word Up.
Yeah, that was like the only hit, wasn't it? Yeah. No, I can't be right. No.
I think it was. Yeah, yeah, it was primarily there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was, I could be able to work out the exact date because because I'm sure the listeners are desperate to know.
Bands used to have the names of tours, yeah. You know, like when the Bowie 80s tour was called the Sirius Moonlight Tour.
Yeah. Up until reality tour names, yeah. We should bring that back.
Cool, yeah.
I think it was like, it felt like a thing, like, I think they still do it maybe with the popular acts that would have a show. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think Kylie would have a named tour. The one I always think of is the Zoo TV tour that you did.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, if you enjoy, as I do, reading blunt Wikipedia descriptions of things.
Yeah, yeah.
The description of the Zoo TV tour where it tries to describe the show is one of the most hilarious things you've ever read.
That's great.
It's really, it's just every sentence is more and more baffling. I'm sure, I think it is available to watch, I'm sure it is.
Yeah.
But I've never watched it, but it's really worth, like.
That's great. One of my favourite Wikipedia things is reading entries for bands that are clearly written by themselves.
Yeah.
The Ned's Atomic Dustbin one. It's got a whole thing where it's like, The album was released in an American format, so didn't chart, which caused controversy. It's all about really bitter things about chart positions and stuff like that. It's great. Anyway, sorry, tangents there. You went to see the Stones.
The Urban Jungle Tour, which is 1990. So the reason I know it's the date is because it was the night England played West Germany in the semi-final of Italia 90 World Cup. Which was,
oh, my God. So you didn't see that game?
Didn't see that game, and that was a big deal to me, Italian 90.
Yeah,
it was
the
first time I got into football. So, so we were big into the Stones, and then I think really the Beatles. What happened at the same time really was the anthology series on ITV. Was it on?
It was on ITV.
I think it was on ITV, and which happened the same time as from the age of seven to about secondary school. I was very much into the charts. I was about buying all. I had a string of Now albums. Yeah. I used to record the charts in the classic way you record the charts. Yeah. And then, when I was 11 or 12, all that kind of Britpop stuff happened. Part Life and Definitely Maybe being the first two kind of breakthrough things that I bought. And I think that turned a lot of people onto the Beatles as well.
Yeah,
because that
was
the same year as the anthology. I think that.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. I think up until that point, I didn't even realize that you're allowed to like old music. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That was the music my dad liked. I like the Prodigy, and I like Gabrielle. Like, I liked the stuff that was in the charts.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I suppose it was Noel Gallagher and Liam Gallagher talking about the Beatles and them being mentioned by journalists.
Mm.
And then that made you watch the anthology. My parents would have watched that anthology anyway, but I'd have thought it was a historical document rather than something about music that I could like, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the common thread for basically, our generation. So many people say that was the turning point in it.
And you've got to remember it was like pre-internet as well, so you're hearing a lot of this stuff and seeing it, you know, for the first time and realizing how it all fits together, because a lot of people would like, you know, you sort of vaguely aware of Sgt. Pepper and then vaguely aware of the kind of early stuff, and but then not really sure how it all fitted together. You know, it was just this, you know, because they're all so different and disparate elements of the story. So,
yeah, totally.
I think,
you know, you probably, if you asked someone who wasn't interested in the Beatles, the things that they would think are the kind of screaming people with the mop top kind of image. And that cover of the Sgt. Pepper's album. I think that's the things that, you know, obviously doesn't quite do the whole thing credit. But I think they're the kind of most, obviously there's millions of iconic, they're the most iconic images of the whole thing, really.
Yeah, yeah.
When you go, how did you get into the Beatles? It's just, it's like every other band, really, you can identify more them coming into your orbit. But I think the Beatles, you know, from at three onwards, you're listening to Ringo Starr on Thomas the Tank Engine. And then, and then, you know, I do remember that the George Harrison album, it's called Cloud Nine.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that must have come out around, when would that have been, 91, 92, something like that?
80s.
Late 80s. Yeah. So we had that, but I wouldn't have connected that to the Beatles until years later.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an interesting one, Cloud Nine. I revisited that for the first time in ages, and it really smells of someone who needs a bit of cash.
Is that got When We Was Fab on it? Is that?
Yeah. It's him having been the first one to sort of reject the whole Beatle legacy, and then suddenly he turns up after being away for over a decade singing rose-tinted songs about meeting the Beatles in Hamburg, and it's just sort of, right, okay. There's probably some renovations in Friar Park that were desperately needed.
I can identify both being struck by a pang of nostalgia, though. Maybe that's what it was.
Yeah. You never know.
It's got a phenomenal cover.
Yeah, which is that cover.
Him in kind of those, I suppose, aviators with a kind of floral shirt, maybe unbuttoned, one too many buttons. Which is a huge kind of distance from the kind of spiritual man you kind of he's previously, you know, he looks like more like Ringo being interviewed by The Pool in Anthology than he looks like himself.
But the idea that the Beatles were kind of just always there, I remember that with my brother telling me about the Beatles, maybe when we were watching Yellow Submarine when I was really young. And like Tom, my brother said, oh yeah, George is the quiet one. I was like, how do you know that? How does those ideas, kind of disseminate through the world? Like, how did he know he was the quiet one? You know what I mean? Like, where do these archetypes come from that you just learn culturally, you know?
To go back to your friend John Robbins, who you will never get on here because he doesn't like the Beatles, I was listening to his radio show.
Yeah.
With him and Ellis's radio show, but he drives it. And but he was talking about how he believed in 100 or 200 years the Beatles would be forgotten.
Fucking
and hell. I was so angry listening to this, because I just don't believe that. I just believe that their impact is so incomparable to every other band that
it's his argument that Queen wouldn't be.
It didn't go there, but I imagine it could have if Ellis had pushed it. But I think his argument was that all music you listen to now will be forgotten, really. Right. But, which is, of course...
Well, I mean, if they manage to... If you can hear sort of Thomas Tallis, you know, English plain song from 800 years ago, the chances are that... That one of the most mass-produced pieces of digital media is probably going to last at least a couple of hundred years.
But that is strange. Unless John was going down a deliberately kind of was he kind of saying there won't be any civilization in 200 years?
No, I think
he was just.
I mean, for all I know, they had 2 minutes to fill before the news, and he was panicking.
Do you want to go into climate panic, or do you want to kind of? That's interesting.
I just feel like they're so part of the tapestry of everything.
Yeah,
and to the point where it's interesting because we were discussing like before this, we were discussing like people you'd possibly get on or like and. You describe someone as a Beatles fan.
Yeah.
And it's a weird thing to be into in a weird way because it's so central to culture. It's like being a fan of, you know, it's like being a fan of Harry Potter. You have to... If you so many people are into it.
Yeah.
Like, there's kind of that... If you take a society from, you know, the spread of it, there's probably... 80% in the middle that are just like the Beatles, and then there's 10% that are really into the Beatles, and 10% that actively dislike the Beatles,
or define themselves in opposition to the Beatles, but secretly quite like the Beatles. It's like saying I like pizza. Like it's a very boring thing to say. And that was the reservation when we started the podcast. Is like, you know, it's sort of definitely a lot of preaching to the choir, but. Yeah, from doing this, we've just found out that actually people love them for so many different reasons.
Yeah. Mm. But I think that's an interesting... It's always hard to know how to talk about things where there is that range of people who are into them kind of casually or into them really obsessively. I remember a similar thing, like this is going to sound really poncy, but like when I was getting quite into James Joyce, right? And in certain circles, like you have to say things like, and in Ulysses, you know, the man in the brown Macintosh famously, and it's like, what do you mean famously? Famously to like 10 people, you know. But like when you're talking about like the Beatles, you kind of you say, you know, like, you know, Martha, my dear, famously starts, you know, to a lot of people, that's not a famous song.
Yeah,
you know,
I can't really imagine like throngs of screaming teenagers outside the release of James Joyce's
sadly
novel.
Not. Yeah, it's a shame.
It might have been,
but you know, but it's weird. You know, to some people, the facts you'd be saying are very well worn and are famous facts. But to other people listening to the show, you know, you might be hearing it for the first time. But it's kind of weird how to couch the way you talk about them. You know, because there is such a presence and so many well-known stories as well.
I think you find that. I find it difficult to talk about music with someone that I'm not completely sure of how into music they are. And I don't mean that as in, oh, guys, I'm like really into music. Are you not aware of the B-sides? I'm not like that. But like, what I mean is like, there'll be people that know far more than you, and there'll be people that know far less. And say someone said to me, I like Blur. And I go, yeah. And then I'd say about something and they wouldn't know about. And I find I kind of almost, I'm terrified of making myself look like a dweeb.
I know what you mean.
But also, on the other side, I feel guilty for not knowing as much as people that know more. I don't know. And it shouldn't be, you know, it's the Ellis James episode thing. But it shouldn't be like, it's not about what you know. Do you know what I mean? But I feel like... there feels like a thing with the Beatles that because it's such a well-known thing, if you're into the Beatles, you really have to throw yourself into being into the Beatles to get beyond what everyone knows.
Well, that's why I thought this is a good idea for a podcast, because you're talking to people about their personal associations. And people can't really get those wrong, you know. So it's like, you know, that's
what... You're getting the Beatles wrong.
I've met James Acaster a couple of times, but when he asks me what I'm listening to, my mind has never gone more blank, because he's got such an insane knowledge of incredibly diverse range of music.
He's got, I totally know what you mean.
It's a terrifying question.
It is.
The question, what music are you into, is the worst question anyone could ask you, I think. Because it's basically asking you to kind of pigeonhole yourself.
Yeah.
I haven't come up with a satisfactory answer that... Well, I don't think you can come up with a satisfactory answer on the one hand, but on the
other... It's a real sort of mum's mate question, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Jack likes music. Deirdre likes music too. Yeah. Oh, what are you into? Yeah. You wouldn't know it.
Yeah.
I think it's probably the only good answer.
I think that's the thing with it. It's like you get this situation where they'll say, you know, what are you into? And if you avoid... I end up avoiding the question, which just looks so kind of... evasively, like kind of suspicious.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I've never actually heard music at all.
Yeah, it's music. Yeah,
yeah. Well, you either have to like, give an answer that's way too long or an answer that's flippantly short. Yeah, and there's not really any in between.
So when you were growing up then, were you kind of torn between music and comedy? Was that a kind of thing? Or were you ever kind of in a band and things like that?
I can play the guitar to not a level where you could be in a band, but a level where you can look at most... You could listen to a song and look at the tab and work out how to play it, that kind of level. And I think, you know, I think probably... every comedian would want to be in a band if they were honest. That's a better career.
Yeah, it does seem to be a recurring theme with the comedians we talk to.
I do think there's like something about, say, I don't know, like your generation of comedians. Like, I remember Ellis talking about the idea of there's a kind of class, as in like a school year of comedians. Mm. But I think you and like James Acaster and Ellis and John have got, there seems to be a real particular crossover with music. With a lot of you guys.
Yeah. I wonder what... I think part of it, maybe, is that when I was growing up in the 90s... Now, I think the worst phrase in the world is comedy is the new rock and roll. Cause it just never has been and it never will be. Yeah. But I think in the 90s on TV, the British comedy was, you know, probably... That's probably... In the way that my dad was lucky to grow up in the 60s for music, I think I was very lucky to grow up in the 90s for comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
And you could probably... I won't do it because I think it would make it a very boring podcast, but you could probably name off the top of your head 25 brilliant comedy shows that would have been on BBC Two or Channel 4 or wherever on Friday nights and just constant recurring... It felt like everything was good.
Yeah.
And it felt like it was all coming from the same kind of generation of people.
Mm.
And I think the people that were into that, that were into Shooting Stars, Father Ted, to the Fast Show, to the Royal Family, to et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
They were also the people that were into music.
Yeah.
I think it was the same group of people at my school.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that is, whether the comedy at the time just was kind of not marketed in the same way, but operated in the same kind of space.
Yeah,
but the people that watched Shooting Stars were the people that liked to read The Enemy.
Yeah.
I think that's possibly what's kind of created a generation of people that... and maybe it's that... So you had the first wave of alternative... I'm pontificating on a theory I've never said before here. So
that's what we like.
I mean, this is a podcast. The whole format. Yeah.
But obviously you had this kind of first wave of alternative comedy that kind of broke through, which was your French and Saunders, Rick Mayall and Adrian Edmondson, and et cetera, et cetera. And then I think that kind of, by the 90s, they were the stadium fillers. They were the Vicar of Dibley and absolutely fabulous.
Yeah.
But that next young generation, comedy was young.
The Vicar of Dibley Serious Moonlight Tour.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It was very cloud night. But so you had that second group coming through, which was for everyone from Harry Hill to Frank Skinner to Paul Whitehouse, et cetera, Vic and Bob, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they were young and they were alternative in the way that bands were, I think.
Yeah.
And I think it was it operated in the same area. So I think if you were into Alan Partridge, if you watched the day to day, you didn't then go and listen to the Spice Girls.
No, well, it felt like they were listening to the same things, like day to day when they're doing, you know, the Nirvana panty smile advert. Do you remember that? And it's like, that song is like really good. Like, it doesn't need to be that good, you know. And like, the, you know, some, so it's like they're listening to the same stuff. That was a big thing with Chris Morris, was that the music was so important to his stuff.
Brilliant.
And
his, when they do, he does the character Fur Q, who's the rapper does Uzi Lover, which is obviously, which is a really well done. It's brilliant. The best bit of that is that he shoots, the thing about him is he shoots someone live on stage.
Yeah.
And it's Mark Goodyear is the person he's going to shoot when he's in London.
So good.
But yeah, it just felt like the same world. It felt, and I think that's why you get that crossover. Matthew Crosby's another person who I'm friends with, who's into comedy and has got that same, and I think it's definitely, it was the same nerds. It was the same nerds.
Yeah. But that's the Beatles as well, isn't it? Because they're, you know, we've talked about this in the last one with Kevin Eldon, but the Beatles crossover where it is the Goons and there's music hall tradition and, you know, the Cavern shows were almost like stand-up at times. They do skits and, you know, they were hilarious, So there is that crossover as well, isn't there? Just...
They showed the last ever John Lennon interview on a documentary last night where he talks about, it's the night before he died, and he talks about Fawlty Towers and how much he's obsessed with the second series of Fawlty Towers.
Wow.
And Andy Peebles is almost trying to change the conversation, but John Lennon just won't stop talking about it. He was like, that's what I want to do, you know, I want to be in Fawlty Towers.
We are sitting in this is the very room, the very room where it happened, you know, the double fantasy was brought alive, as it were, in this very bloody room, wasn't it, dear?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. You're wasted, Mr. Lennon, you're wasted.
I love Fawlty Towers. I'd like to be in that, you know.
Would you?
I mean, part of me would sooner have been a comedian, you know. I just don't have the guts to stand up and do it, but I'd love to be in the Monty Python. Fawlty Towers is the greatest show I've seen in years. If they have it over here now. God, it's great. I mean, what a guy, he's great.
I saw an interview, or maybe I had a conversation with him, but I saw Noel Fielding, or heard him talk about walking down, like Dean Street or somewhere like that, and there was someone shouting at him, and he turned around, and it was Paul McCartney.
Really?
And he was like, I'm a big fan of the Mighty Boosh. I think it's great.
Wow.
God, how do you react to that?
Yeah.
That Christ. Even makes me feel a bit queasy.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd ever recover.
Yeah,
but they're big comedy fans as well, aren't they? Like, you know, even Paul McCartney liked all that sort of 90s stuff as well, I think, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, there's a great TFI throwaway. I don't know if it's great because I haven't watched it in 25 years.
I watched it the other day, I think.
Did you?
Well, the one with Paul McCartney where he does the Flaming Pie thing.
Yeah,
so... he's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's so funny.
He plays all. Don't they do a the live thing is him playing all the different instruments?
Like. Yeah. This happened, because it was the whatever anniversary of, or they reissued Flaming Pie the other day, and I had the I think we mentioned it on the podcast, but I had probably one of the biggest Proustian rushes I've ever had listening to the single off that song, and then suddenly remembering every second of a whole 90 minutes of TFI Friday. And I went back to watch it on YouTube and realised that I knew entire sections of dialogue of it off by heart from recording it off the telly. Yeah, he's brilliant. He's really, I mean, Chris Evans is more obnoxious than I remembered.
You might remember.
But yeah, he's properly firing on all cylinders, really, really, being, you know, got a comeback for everything. And, considering what he was going through at that time as well, because it was a pretty tough time for Paul. Yeah. I think it was just months before Linda died. Jeez. And then they disappear at the end onto the, you know, and speedboat going under Hammersmith Bridge. And it's really, really crazy.
So talking about 90s stuff and 90s comedy, do you remember, Kate Bush was given, She's obviously very reclusive.
Mm.
But she was given a Lifetime Achievement Award. Maybe it's a Brit Award or something like that.
Mm.
Or maybe an Ivor Novello or something. And she came on stage and she did... Do you remember that character that Charlie Higson did in the Fast Show where he'd be talking and then he'd go, oh, sorry, I've just come. Like Kate Bush came on stage and that's what she said, wow. Sorry, I've just come. And like loads of people... I remember this at the time, like, people didn't get the reference.
Yeah, it's not a well-enough, even in 1997, not a well-enough Fast Show sketch.
Deep cut.
Yeah, it's quite a deep cut, yeah.
She could do Brilliant. She's just one. She could have done the Brilliant Paul Whitehouse character.
Yeah, yeah. But that's, I love the idea of Kate Bush watching Fast Show, but, you know.
Yeah, Bowie was another one who was obsessed with the Fast Show as well.
He used to
sort of do really bad. And, you know, I love the guy who goes, brilliant, brilliant, it's fantastic. put some more effort into it, Amy.
He was big into The Office, wasn't he, David Bowie?
Yeah.
And obviously ended up in extras. But there's a very good YouTube video of him. It's kind of, I think it might be to promo extras or something. But he's... talking, kind of doing a pastiche of an arrogant David Bowie, where he's talking about how he's given Ricky Gervais all of his good jokes. And what you realise is David Bowie's, he's a really funny comic actor. Do you know what he's really good at?
Yeah, the Ruttles, the second Ruttles film that came out. Are you a big Ruttles fan, Josh?
I haven't seen the second one.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't bother. he basically did it in about 2003 or something without any input from Neil Innes, so it's like recut stuff. But it's an absolute shit show, apart from David Bowie does an interview in the style of the sort of Mick Jagger one from the original Ruttles.
It's
absolutely... Well, it's bonkers, but it's brilliant. Yeah, he's really, really funny. It's worth just selecting that clip.
But I saw David Bowie at Glastonbury in 2000.
Oh, wow.
And what was interesting... So I was thinking about that the other day, and I Googled it to see, like, what the lineup was, and what came up was, like, some review from 2000 in The Independent, maybe, or something like that, but a proper broadsheet. And what was fascinating was it said, his opening was about how Glastonbury hadn't got the money of the other festivals, who'd got all of the big acts.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And Glastonbury had to, and they said they'd had to settle for Travis and David Bowie.
Wow.
And it was like...
Yeah, but that's the thing, like, it's before Another Day, that one.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
There was that kind of just suggestion that his time had gone and, like, maybe he wouldn't do another album.
Oh, yeah.
There'd obviously been rumours about him. But then it was kind of... It's kind of this almost six musicification where there's this kind of... I remember Ellis saying when David Bowie died, it was like the Pope had died on six music. You know, it was this incredible, like... It's just... It's weird. And like you say, like 20 years ago, he was more part of the furniture, which is incredibly strange to think
about now. It's so weird. Because my head, it had been a historic... moment that David Bowie had played Glastonbury, but I probably just built that into my own narrative afterwards.
His stock was quite low, and there's a similar thing that's happened with these, like, every then time there's a big John Lennon anniversary, then people talk about Double Fantasy in a similar sort of way. And it's like Double Fantasy is probably the worst album ever to win a Grammy for best album for that reason. And then I was listening to Six Music this morning and people were going on about how brilliant Double Fantasy is. There's a reason why every secondhand record shop in the country has at least five copies of Double Fantasy for a pound. Because it's the album that everyone bought but no one ever listened to.
I saw Paul McCartney when he did Glastonbury in 04, was it, or was it 05?
Yeah.
05. That did feel like it mattered in the way that I remember David Bowie, but obviously was misled myself. But it felt like a hugely importantly one-off experience, which, of course, it was not going to be until COVID struck, and maybe it will still be a one-off experience.
Yeah,
but like that was a really amazing to see. You know, that's the... I've seen Paul McCartney again since, but that felt like a gig that I'm really... There's very few gigs you're at where you feel like it's an event. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%. That's funnily enough, talking of your Rolling Stones World Cup thing, I saw him in 2010 in Hyde Park, the day that England got thrashed by Germany in the 4-5-1 or whatever it was. I was so depressed we almost didn't go. Which now, since we looked, we were just like, is anyone in the mood to go to this fucking thing? Like, we're all quite hungover and we were planning it in our minds that we would watch the football, beat the Germans, go after Paul McCartney, have a nice sing song, and didn't really consider that we might get thrashed. It was an odd vibe because everyone was a bit. They played it on the big screen there while poor old Elvis Costello was plugging away to a load of foreign tourists. And then he came on, and it was absolutely the best time I've ever seen him. It was unforgettable. Yeah. The fact that I even considered not going is nuts.
What I love about, so when I saw him later, so it would have been about 2011 or maybe even 10, he played Hammersmith Apollo for two nights before Christmas.
And I
got a ticket for one of them. And it was, I don't know why he was doing it, but presumably just for fun, really, because...
Yeah. He played the 100 Club and two dates at the House of Apollo.
Yeah, and it was nuts. Amazing. And he came on, and I think he did say something like his opening was like, let's have some fun. And you were just like, this is a man that genuinely wants to do this in the way that if you go and see the Rolling Stones, you don't feel that they want to do this. Do you know? I think Paul McCartney has got, I mean... He just wants to be playing music.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. There's rumours of a lockdown album, isn't there?
He
might have been recording during this time. Yeah.
He did his first TikTok this week, which... which is exactly how you would expect it to be.
Does he slip into patois like he did in that?
Luckily, he doesn't say anything, but he's dancing around to a sort of... a contemporary pop hit that I can't say I know the name of, but it's it's pretty. It might as well be.
I don't know why he needs to do that. No, do you know what I mean?
Well, it's the double-edged sword of his boundless enthusiasm that you were just referring to, really, isn't it?
Exactly.
If you want the man who literally wants to have fun every time, you know, he's played Osaka for the 18th time in his career.
But that's
also
great.
The guy
who's
going to do TikTok.
We've talked about Dylan before, haven't we? But like, do you feel Dylan, when you saw Dylan, his heart's not in it?
It's a weird one because he's on a never-ending tour. So unless he has done some kind of grotty deal with the devil, what's he doing it for?
Wise, he's on top form, you know. But
that's
when he plays. I wonder what that decision he makes about playing live. I mean, Van Morrison's another one, which is whenever he plays live, it's like you don't want to be here. Do you?
No, he's going off on time and all that. But then Van Morrison's the first person that's annoyed at the lockdown because he can't play live. I think what's kind of from the experience of touring myself, obviously, you know, some gigs matter more than others. And I refuse to believe that the Rolling Stones or Bob Dylan on date 200 are still excited. Also because they can't, at least at the end of every tour as a comedian, I start again. I'm not still doing jokes. If I do a joke from 4 years ago, I feel a bit done with it. So I don't know, but then maybe I don't think I've got that thing that Paul McCartney's got, clearly, that passion. I mean, you know, there's many things that Paul McCartney's got that I haven't got.
But that's a weird thing with comedy, though, isn't it? I mean, like, you know, comedy is about reinvention, isn't it? You can't just go and do old routines. Or do sometimes you find that audiences want you to do routines they're familiar with?
I've never found that.
No.
I don't know if you've heard that kind of story about Michael McIntyre's doing a gig, like a new material gig, and he gets to the end and he's like, he's just trying stuff out. He's like, has anyone got any questions? Someone goes, do the material about getting a bus in the snow. And he goes, that's not a question. And then he goes, any other questions? And the guy puts his hand up and goes, have you ever had to get a bus in the snow? But I don't know. It's not the same, is it? It's the new material, old material thing is almost exactly the opposite in comedy and music. Yeah. I always think, and Paul McCartney must suffer this hugely, I always think it must slightly hurt every time you say you're going to do something that isn't the Beatles.
Yeah.
Or a new song. And we can all feel the shuffle to the bar, or we can all hear the I'm aware of the sound. When I'm at a gig, I'm aware of the different cheers that each song will get. Paul McCartney must be hyper aware of it.
Yeah, I mean, no one's more aware than him, I guess. And he knows that he only... There's a reason why he only plays two singles of whatever album he's touring.
Ooh, wow.
But then the other... Like, when that gig that I just mentioned, I remember he played Ramon, which is... You know, for me, I absolutely love that song. One of my favourite songs on Ram, even though it's only sort of 90 seconds long. And then everyone just turned around and left, and they're like, oh, he's playing some of his new shit. Right. It's on Ram. Like, you're literally here to hear, like, Paperback Writer and Daydreamer.
Do we know, has he ever said, like, has he ever been asked, how does that feel? I'd love to know.
Yeah.
What? I think he has, and he's very honest about it. He's like... You know, I know people will come... Because he, like, in the Wings days, he didn't start playing Beatles songs until very late 70s.
Mm. Yeah, and they were quite... They weren't the big hits, really, were they?
Started with, like, Lady Madonna, and then used to play, like, sort of Let It Be. And now it's sort of, like, 70, 80%. But I suppose it's more... Like, now, because Wings are having a bit more of a resurgence, he plays a bit more sort of Wingsy stuff. Ooh. And he played like Temporary Secretary last time I saw him.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you think that's the bits he enjoys the most? I don't know what the answer is like. I'd just be fascinated to know when he's playing stuff like that, or whether he's playing, when he's playing a song off the new album, is he thinking, this one's for me and I'm going to really enjoy this? Or is he going, I can just fucking see them moving around and it's absolutely like. I don't know.
Well, it must be like you're there to plug the record and you've got to at least pretend that you enjoy it. And now one of my new songs, which is nowhere near as good as any of my old songs.
With his more experimental stuff and like the Fireman stuff, you know, I think he's enjoying is how he's, you know, subverting expectations of what people want from him, you know. But maybe he is just relish. I like the Fireman stuff and, you know, the more experimental end of his, what he's doing. But I think, who knows? I don't know.
Yeah. But you only have to sort of look around at the crowd at one of those gigs to realise that, you know, 99% of people are there to hear, you know, a very specific set of songs.
Yeah, but, yeah.
And they absolutely love it. And, you know, the older he gets, I think the more willing he is to just... be a walking greatest hits tour.
I think also he's probably not got the same neuroses as me, in the sense of I don't think he's there thinking, am I going to lose them here? Like, thinking, he's confident that he can come back with a couple of songs that aren't.
I'd love to see him do a noise set though. You know, God.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When I saw, I remember seeing Springsteen at Glastonbury, and I was struck by the demographic there where, so it was one of those years at Glastonbury where there's like, you know, I think they were always doing it now, there's like so many flags, and there was a Springsteen fan just started talking to this woman next to me, and Springsteen wasn't on for like another 4 hours. And he said, you know, those flags are going to get in the way of people trying to watch Bruce Springsteen later. I think there's a lot of people who are quite, that sounds really weird, but like, it's almost like a collecting thing where you want to kind of preserve something in amber and don't have any of the distractions of life around you. You want to absorb this moment of historical importance of seeing Paul McCartney or someone like Bruce Springsteen. Do you know what I mean? Like,
I totally know what you mean. It's that thing of being at a gig, certainly with Glastonbury as well, you'll probably be smashed by the time they come on.
Yeah.
So how much of Paul McCartney do I remember from being there? And how much do I remember because I've watched it on YouTube loads of times when I've got him drunk? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm.
But those sort of legend slots at Glastonbury, they are a bit of a sort of box-ticking exercise because, you know, I can say I've seen The Who, but I haven't really seen The Who. You know, I've seen The Who in 2009 on the Pyramid stage from about half a mile away. Yeah.
But then that's the thing, if you allow for a bit of the chaos to enter. Like, I remember I was at a music festival in Australia, Byron Bay blues jazz blues. Anyway, it was the Pogues were headlining, and you know, I sort of just drifted along to see it, and I was absolutely like blown away. It's probably one of the best gigs I've ever seen.
Wow.
But it was chaotic, and you know, it was part of a festival, and that's why I loved it. It wasn't too formal. I think that's what I'm trying to say. I wasn't trying to just watch it and enjoy seeing this kind of very famous band. I was just in that kind of festival spirit, I guess. And
I think one of the things, the advantages of festivals or big festival is, you know, you see someone on a Tuesday night in London.
Yeah.
And you do go, half the people here are thinking about getting whether they're going to make their train. You know, there's all babysitter issues. There's all kinds of things. Shall we beat the rush to the tube because we don't want to see unless you go and see a band almost on a Friday or a Saturday night. No one's, it doesn't feel like it's free. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it feels like, you know, what was the last gig I went to see? I haven't been to see a gig for ages, obviously, because I've just realised we're under lockdown. I went to see Fontaines DC at Brixton Academy.
Mm.
I was with Ellis, actually. There was about five of us. And it was like Tuesday night. I was like, do you know what? I'm not going to have a drink because I've got to work tomorrow. Like, what is this event that I'm doing?
You're kind of slightly relieved when it's over. You know, it's like, is this the last song? There's another one.
I'm going to treat myself to an Uber. That's what I'm going to do.
That's so weird. But it's weird though. Yeah, but so festivals, sometimes it can go terribly wrong, but sometimes it can really hit the sweet spot and like, you actually genuinely experience something magical watching something live.
Well,
you know?
I think
I've had that more at festivals than at a regular gig.
Like I was saying to you about, you know, after 200 gigs, what's special to the band anymore? Mm. But I think there's certain gigs that, you know, I think that's one of the things, you're right, it is a kind of jukebox gig, the headlining Glastonbury. Mm. But conversely, it is also a gig that you know is important in that band's diary all year.
You know
that they've circled that as this is the one that I need to do well at. This is the one I care about. And I think there's a lot to be said for that element being part of it. Mm. And just convincing, even if you're convincing yourself of that, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it can absolutely tip it over the edge into like unforgettable. You know, yeah. Have you seen sort of like Blur? When did Blur headline the Pyramid Stage? 2009?
Oh, or I was at that one.
I didn't see
amazing.
That, and it's probably the greatest heartbreak of my life. But
that was like a proper moment where you
were you there at that
you track? Take stock and think, "This is I'm very lucky to be here." Mm. Which you don't tend to get, you know, you're very lucky if you get there at Brixton Academy and Damon Albarn's crying. It's so beautiful.
Yeah. That was amazing. I was at that gig. That was incredible.
I didn't go that year because I'd just been through a breakup.
Right.
And and my girlfriend went and I didn't. My ex-girlfriend, I should say.
Mm. Fucking hell.
Well, double whammy.
Ideally edit that because it is 11 years. But yeah, it was
It wasn't that good.
No, yeah. Was...
But that I don't understand anyone that can watch Glastonbury when they haven't been there or they weren't there. These when I'm not there and Glastonbury's on the TV, it just feels like an incomparable experience. I don't find any joy in watching these bands that and thinking I wish I was there or thinking that looks rubbish. Do you know what I mean? It just it doesn't translate to TV for me in any way, really.
It's similar. I find this exactly the same feeling watching most stand-up on TV.
Totally agree.
Yeah. And I guess when you watch something like, taking it back to the Beatles, when you, that Ron Howard film where it's all about the sort of Shea Stadium thing, it's like, it just seems, you feel so far removed from it. And like, I thought that film was actually, failed in trying to sort of express what it was like to the madness of the Beatles, which has been done in lots of brilliant films. Hard Day's Night does a better job of it and stuff. And when you watch them play Shea Stadium, and it's a similar thing of them knowing that that's the last one, or the rooftop gig where, you know, they're like, this is a gig of significance and everything is upped. And
I think that's... I think that's the thing, is like thinking, have they been nervous before they walked on stage? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Someone told me that one of the most, I don't know who it was, someone I know who works in the music industry said one of the most amazing things they've ever seen is that they were at the side of the stage for the Rolling Stones at Glastonbury in 2013. Mm. And they, at the end of the gig, they watched as the band united to say goodnight together. And then they walked off. As they walked off, four limousines pulled up straight away. They all walked straight into the fort and they were gone within like 30 seconds.
Wow.
And it was just like they just disappeared. Yeah. Like this military precision operation.
That's amazing.
I couldn't believe like how amazingly like so precise and like what a thing it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
when I played a Green Man with Jan Tiersen, who I used to play with, and it's bizarre actually because we were on the main stage after Van Morrison, because Van Morrison was headlining but he wanted to get away earlier. And so I can say Van Morrison supported me, but But Van Morrison left the stage, his band was still going, and you're looking at the stage and this helicopter went off behind. I might be misremembering this, but I'm sure it's true. But the band was still playing the last song, and Van was in the air on his way back to whatever he does on his own.
So he gets to a festival, go, could you close this one for me? Like, I've got to go.
That's like a comedy thing. Do you mind if I go on first? Because
I've got a longer drive than you. That's absolutely mad, isn't it? I wouldn't think Van Morrison was a big enough deal anymore. Not to sound like Bowie 2000, but I wouldn't have thought it was a big enough deal to be move down a festival set at will.
Well, I think he hit the kind of that sort of slightly good prime time slot early evening thing, I think. And it was kind of family friendly, I guess. But Van Morrison has toured every year, you know, since COVID, much to his chagrin.
He seems to be putting in like a sort of almost sarcastic amount of dates at the moment, because yeah. I think I follow him on sort of Ents24 or whatever it is at the moment, so I get a notification every time. And every time one gets cancelled, you can hear me like, oh, fuck, see, I can do 10 more of that. COVID thing.
Oh, that's great. He used to play a pub near me. He used to know a landlord in Ashburton in Devon.
Wow.
It was called The Lanterns on Dartmoor. It would be a pub that would have, like, you know, a kind of, I remember my friend's band playing there.
Really?
But Van Morrison would have played occasionally. This must have been mid to late 90s. He'd occasionally just do a gig there because he was mates with the landlord.
Really? Did you ever see him there?
No, because at the time, it didn't mean anything. He didn't mean anything to me. I wasn't into Van Morrison. So it must have been early. It was before I was aware that seeing Van Morrison in a pub would be a good thing. If you know what I mean.
God. I'd worry that COVID has made us be kind of so nostalgic for just anything like that, like any scraps. You know, I mean, that's a good scrap, Van Morrison playing in a pub. But you know what I mean? Like, the way we talk about the 60s now, of kind of, or, you know, even the 90s, is kind of like how we're talking about last year now with COVID. You know what I mean? Like,
It's definitely, but I think that's, you know, if nostalgia in a weird way gets a kind of bad rap. And I'm not, I would never say that, like, oh God, the past is so much better. But I think one of the things that I get most, to take it back to the Beatles, that I get most out of listening to it, is just kind of imagining what their life was like as they recorded this. Imagining what it was like to be in 1968 and be in the Beatles. And I think I think that's the thing. We talk about them being part of the culture, but I think that's part of what makes it magical, is that it, unlike any other band, everything associated with them kind of is so exciting and frames it in such a way that it, while the songs are peerless, I think it goes far beyond that, in that it's that kind of narrative that is kind of defined pop music ever since. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I just don't think you, to go back on your own podcast, Guy Chambers said about whether, you know, Beyonce is the same level now, but I just don't think anything could ever be of that level or could ever repeat that, because everything's too connected, everything's too based on what's gone before. There's no innocence to anything. Everything is in the sense that could Beyonce be compared to the Beatles, it ruins the question in itself, because, you know, the fact she's being compared to the Beatles shows that everything's kind of comparable to that, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Definitely the cultural sort of framework is so incomparable now to how it was then. And maybe, like, the Beatles' resurgence during Britpop is because we got a little tiny taste of that with, you know, superstar bands that were everywhere, like Oasis. You know, it was a fraction of what the Beatles were, but it was something that was comparable for the first time, so everyone was really quick to pick that ball up and sort of run with it and compare.
And do you think the Beatles, the other key way that the Beatles' time is comparable to that time in the mid-90s, is that it was happening to a very small amount of people in London, and we imagine the 60s as London, and you imagine the 90s as Damien Hirst in the Groucho with Alex James, but in actual fact, we all know. I don't know where you were, but I was never fucking near that. You know what I mean? Most people didn't live that, and that. But to us, because we didn't live through it, it feels like the Beatles was.
Well, yeah, I think nostalgia's made them perfect in a way. You know, we've kind of, that story, you know, they didn't put a foot wrong. You know, I tried to say this in another podcast, I didn't quite get it right, but did you ever like REM in the 90s?
Not in the same way that other people like R.E.M., but I like R.E.M., do you know what I mean?
Sure, yeah, because yeah.
I wouldn't say I'm an R.E.M. fan as my question, what music do you like? If
but, like, I loved Automatic for the People, like, after it had come out. Like, my brother had it on tape, and it was just, I just thought it was, like, a perfect album. And then I was kind of around and conscious of them when Monster came out, which was the 94 album, which was like slightly more grungy, and it was a huge thing. Like, they did a huge stadium tours, you know, and I was just aware that somehow they've lost it, that this isn't as good. And like, and it, I, looking back now, it was because it was happening in the present. Whereas, you know, Automatic for the People was something I got in after the fact, and the Beatles were something obviously we experience after the fact, so you look back at it and it's not sullied by being in the present.
Sounds,
you know, there's no, they didn't put a foot wrong because we've kind of made it into history and into memory. And well, I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, it's that
this might
thing
be the Stella's
of like
talking.
what effect would the Beatles' legacy, would there have been a huge effect on the Beatles' legacy if John Lennon had still been alive and they'd reformed for a string of Serious Moonlight style megatours? How much
absolutely.
Would that have,
100%. I think there's some of, and also you forget that there was this kind of unanswered question throughout the whole of the 70s of would they, will they, won't they, every one of them asked to, and then there's a very abrupt full stop put on that when John Lennon gets gunned down, and then you can start to reassess the legacy now that the idea of them getting back together is never going to happen. And I think that really kind of helps. And it's like people are still banging on about like the Smiths reunions and stuff now, and it's like...
Well, I think that ship sailed in the last 2 years.
That's true.
If you can give Morrissey credit for one thing, that he stopped the talk of the Smiths reunions.
Maybe that's all part of his game plan. It's only one way I'm going to put this to bed. I've got to become an abominable racist.
Wow.
Work like Christ. A charm.
But yeah, I was obsessed with the idea of a Smiths reunion for the last, up until 2018, maybe. Kind of was, if someone had said to me, who would be your dream band to see live, I'd say the Smiths. But I'm probably glad it didn't happen. I saw the Stone Roses in Heaton Park.
Yeah, awful.
It was awful.
Yeah. Was it?
It was terrible. I saw them in Finsbury Park, and they would... I mean, it was a fun day because you're with a lot of fans celebrating. I mean, the best thing that came out of it was the Shane Meadows documentary, and then the gigs were like a sort of terrible DVD extra.
I bet there was a lot of Adidas going on there. It must have been wall to wall.
It was the scariest atmosphere I've ever been in at a gig, I think. Yeah, because there was... you know, at festival or big gigs where there's just, well, any bar, isn't it? There's just no queue system. And there was so much crushing at the bar, they closed the bars.
Fuck.
Oh, God.
So
it's which one was, way to make a load of Manx really
it was,
angry.
It's just lots of angry Manx. No ability to get any alcohol despite everyone having drunk all day. Fuck. And then they were kind of, in, you know, like the talk of these kind of circuit breaker lockdowns we might do for COVID. They were kind of trying to intermittently open the bar to calm people down and then have to close it back up again. It was carnage.
But musically, was it as bad as with the way I remember it? And I remember the rhythm section being really good, but Ian Brown's singing just being I've seen him a few times.
The sound quality was bad as well, because it was, you know, it just like it. It was difficult to tell. Like, so it was one of those things where it was getting blown about in the wind and stuff, and the sound quality was all over the shop. And then there's no public transport, so we had to walk back into Manchester. The whole thing was...
Wow.
Yeah. I wasn't going to go because I'd seen Ian Brown a few times before, and I'm like, I really love that record, but I'm not a huge Stone Roses fan. And I was reviewing films at the time, and I interviewed Shane Meadows for the documentary that he made.
Yeah.
And I told him that I had a ticket, but I was going to sell it because, you know, I'm trying to save a bit of money or whatever. And he was like, look, if you do one thing in your life, mate, you go to that gig. It'll be amazing.
Oh, wow.
It's absolute bollocks. But, thanks, Shane.
Do you feel that Free as a Bird in any way damages the Beatles? Reputation.
No, I really like Free as a Bird.
Yeah, I like Free as a Bird. I mean, it was, looking back, it's kind of a weird thing to do. There's something. It's
an odd coda. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like an odd. But I'm not so much in that it's a terrible song, because obviously there's terrible songs in their canon, but like in the sense of, you know, we talk about whether if they got back together that would have ruined their reputation. They might have done good stuff, but it's whether the one of the beauties of it is quite how short the whole thing was.
Yeah.
How there's that full stop.
Mm. Yeah. I think it was because of the way it came about. It was that they were, when they agreed to do the anthology, they were going to make, the original idea was to make some sort of incidental music, the three of them, which sounds like a pretty bad idea. And then Yoko was like, okay, you can have these two demos that have been knocking around.
Yeah.
And then when they like realized the technology, like my only gripe with it is the sort of, you know, Jeff Lynne might have been the only person around who had the sort of technical capability to do it. Mm. But it's just, it's the production on it is so Jeff Lynne-y.
Yeah.
Right.
That you would have preferred it sounded, you know, they had sort of made it sound a bit more sort of retrograde. And you can also tell in the DVD extras of the anthology that George Harrison really doesn't want to be there. And that's a bit sort of hard to watch.
Yeah. I remember John Peel at the time of Free as a Bird saying how much he kind of didn't like the Paul edition of it. The whatever happened to...
Oh, really?
You know, because he just thought it was just such a... He said, like, John would have hated that. It was, like, too obvious. It, you know, I don't know. It's part of...
Yeah.
I mean, it's very mawkish. It's very kind of sentimental, classic Paul kind of thing. That line, isn't it?
There's a good... well, and also just doesn't mean anything in true Paul style.
Yeah.
It's the most phatic language. And then he didn't... I think he said that he really didn't enjoy doing the Real Love version because the song was finished and the reason why he got so excited about the Free as a Bird was that it felt like they were collaborating again because he had that bridge to put in and stuff.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think the Lennon part of that song is great. It is really beautiful.
And it's a technical marvel when you listen to the cassette demo that they managed to get anything out of it. Just a good job that they stopped there and didn't go and do that to a load of other records.
Didn't do a two-pack.
hologram John on stage.
It's lucky that there's... I mean, there's not hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of stuff that there would be now, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I think it felt exciting at the time, but it...
Yeah.
I don't know when I'd ever put it on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
When I suppose one of the reasons you wouldn't put it on is it's very... Because it's a single in its sense. If I think I'm going to listen to the Beatles, I probably... It's so unlikely that I then take the step to go, and that song is going to be Free as a Bird.
It's not many people's first dances at their weddings, I'd imagine.
I remember it's anyone's favourite Beatles song. Jeff Lynne's.
Yeah, I remember every day going to school, we used to... I went got a lift with a DT teacher who'd play Classic Gold. There's like an oldie station. And Free as a Bird was the only time they ever played a contemporary song. It felt kind of historical at the time.
I used to, when I did XFM, the next room, if you were... So it's the XFM studio, but if you're pre-recording, there's like a different part of the building.
Mm.
And the next studio was Gold, which would be playing out, but there was never a DJ in there.
It's automated. Wow. But like, what do you mean? You never saw a DJ in there?
Just never saw someone in there, but you'd always just be playing out like song after song.
Hi ho, silver lining and stuff.
Capital God. Well, am I right in this is very tangential, but am I right in thinking that they used to play football commentary on Capital Gold in the 90s?
Yeah, they did.
Jonathan Pierce used
to
say,
because there's a kind of there's a bit of football commentary where Jonathan Pierce is doing Capital Gold, and they're sponsored by something. Do you remember when England let in a goal after 8 seconds against San Marino?
Oh, yeah, I remember that because my friend at school the next day said he'd timed it and it was much longer because it was in slow motion.
I don't know what they were sponsored by, but Jonathan Pearce was contractually obliged to do this intro at kickoff. So it went, and that's hello, I'm Jonathan Pearce. This is England versus San Marino kicking off on Capital Gold in association with Carlsberg Export, and it's 1-0 to San Marino.
Carlsberg stocks.
That's amazing.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So, Josh, one question that we ask everyone on the show, we only have one stock question. Do you have a controversial Beatles opinion?
Yeah, I do, which I find 70% of Sgt. Pepper unlistenable.
That's controversial.
That's an interesting one, though, the Sgt. Pepper thing.
I think you
do your reasons, because I've got my reasons.
I think there's standout songs that are obviously brilliant in their own right.
Mm.
But I find the concept of Sgt. Pepper's very annoying.
Right.
Mm. I find the kind of... I think what I don't like, I never like in music, is I'm not into quirky sounds.
Mm. Right.
Whether that be a kind of... A circus style sound, or
the penny whistle, the whoopee cushion,
yeah, exactly.
The clacker.
Anything that's kind of, you know, end of the pier, I suppose. I have the same problem, which would be another controversial opinion, with the Beach Boys and Pet Sounds. I have the same problem that I find too much of that get into the quirky sound section.
Yeah.
And that's not like. It's not a reasoned opinion, and it's not something that I think is correct, but it's something that I'm not going out and going, I think Pet Sounds is bad. I've really tried.
Really?
Because I know, do you know, and I, right, in that sense, yeah. if I really tried to like this, because I know by definition I should, because everything else, everyone that likes it likes the same stuff as me.
Mm.
But I can never get beyond the quirky sounds. I think Sgt. Pepper's is too full of them.
Right.
Mm. And is there any sort of particular offenders? I'm assuming we're talking sort of When I'm 64, Benefit,
yeah,
and
Benefit
Mr. Kite.
Mr. Kite is pretty unbearable for that.
We got a tweet this week from someone saying, stop slagging off Benefit of Mr. Kite. sorry, that guy. Weird hill to die on.
the Sgt. Pepper in itself, the opening song, is a good song, but then I think it goes into... Even crowd sound I find annoying.
The hubbub and
there's a great bit in the Fab Fools book, the Jem Roberts book, where he's talking about how Paul McCartney loved the idea of when he was listening to radio comedy and there was a physical joke and you heard the audience laughter. He loved that kind of surreal juxtaposition of just laughter on its own. So that's why he wanted to include that in Sgt. Pepper, the laughter and you don't know why they're laughing. It's very odd, isn't it, when you think about it?
I once was... I don't know what I was a guest on Danny Baker's show on Radio 5.
Mm.
And I think Danny Baker's a superb broadcaster. And it was just like an interview. And he went to press a sound effect, or whatever you'd call it in radio. They've got a better name than that. Graham, maybe? Yeah. And he pressed the wrong one. And it was like a kind of... I can't remember what it was, but it was like a long bit of music. It was a long bit of music that you'd have behind a magician or something. And instead of cancelling it, he kind of went along with it and he hushed us. And then he made us kind of occasionally applaud as if there was magic tricks suddenly going on within
the
loop.
Oh, that's very
And it was really
clever.
Like, I was just like so kind of bowled over that he'd made such a brave choice to do that rather than go, God, cocked up there.
Yeah, that's
but
good.
That was a time when I enjoyed quirky sounds, but I'm not going, this is annoying to everyone. It doesn't play with me in some way, in the same way that...
I think a lot of, you get away with a lot under the umbrella of psychedelia, whereas I think the worst offender of that is Uncle Albert on Ram, where he just does a telephone noise where he goes like... But right. just with his mouth, though, it's not even a real telephone. What an incredibly odd decision. This yeah. really beautiful song with George Martin strings all over it.
He'd tried to stretch the telephone into the studio room, but he couldn't quite get it in, yeah. so he had to do it
yeah.
himself.
Yeah, we got an hour.
Yeah. My thing with Sgt. Pepper is I always found, like, I remember when I first heard it, and there were certain songs. This is a really obvious point, but there were certain songs I loved, and I always loved "Fixing a Hole," and I always loved "She's Leaving Home" and "Day in the Life." Mm. But like, you could never just play a bit to someone. It's like when I first heard it, I just loved the whole thing, and it was like I've had a cassette deck, and my dad taped the vinyl copy for me, and it was like hearing sunlight or something. Every song was part of this vibe. And even if those individual parts didn't all match up, it was the first time, I guess, I loved an album because I loved every bit of it. So I know we've been a bit like critical of Sgt. Pepper and Benefit of Mr. Kite and stuff, but that I it's one of those things you could never play. Oh, like have a listen to Mr. Kite, you'll love this. No, you just listen to the whole thing, and it works.
My problem with Sgt. Pepper is, this is my problem with concept albums in general.
Yeah.
Is that I get the feeling like that they're always half a concept album,
yeah,
and half the best songs that you've also got kicking around.
Yeah, well, that's yeah. they'd run out of ideas after the first song.
Of course, because you don't. So it's a bit like when you see a comedian's Edinburgh show, and they've clearly got a concept, but they've also got the 20 minutes that's really working for them at the moment. So they'll kind of deliver in the bit about washing machines or whatever.
To bookend it with the illusion of structure in the middle and call it a reprise at the end.
I don't know if you... What's that second album by The Streets? Is it A Grand Don't Come For Free? I don't know.
That was
like this concept album about...
But there is a through line to that.
There is a through line. That's almost the most conceptual... Most consistently conceptual album I've ever heard.
It's actually got a narrative and a story. Yeah. And
but I don't think the narrative really helps after you've heard it the first time, because there's a twist, and you're like, I don't know how much I need a twist at the end of an album.
It's like watching Sixth Sense over and over again.
The last 10 minutes are great. But I think they admit that they sort of gave up on the concept idea after they had... written the first few, I think it's only the first two songs, and then they're just like, I can't really be bothered with this anymore.
I
think the thing with Sgt. Pepper's is you always presume it's the best one because it's got the most, when you're a kid, it's got the most iconic cover. It's like the image of the Beatles, and it's the most famous, it is the most famous Beatles album, really, I'd say. But it's probably not even in the top five.
A lot of it comes from America as well, where in America it's much more heralded as the finest Beatles record, because the release of Revolver was so mishandled in America that a lot of people never had that record, and the version of it that they did have had alternate track listings. I remember it's always the record that gets spoofed in, like, The Simpsons or whatever. Rob Sheffield talks about it in his book, and it was very, like... much not in the American public consciousness until later. So if you think about those American parodies of The Simpsons or whatever, they're all, you know, you would never see a copy of Revolver anywhere. But I suppose the fact that that cover is so iconic. But I'll dig my heels in for Sgt. Pepper, actually. It might just be because it was the first one that I fell in love with, but listening back to the... there's something about the ambition of it and the ballsiness of we're the best band in the world. We've just made Revolver and this is what we're going to do next. And it's going to absolutely blow your socks off. You know, I quite like that sort of, in any record where everyone's remit is go, it's like homogenic or something. Yeah. Anywhere where they're like, let's go as big as possible.
I had a thing, was certainly growing up and getting into music, where whenever there was a big iconic album, I'd sort of getting into Astral Weeks, it was a journey. Like, why do so many people say this is great?
Yeah.
And getting into Trout Mask is like the Everest of those kinds of things.
I'm still very much at the bottom of that one.
I'm a bass camper.
It's one of those things where, and Pet Sounds as well. Like, it took me a long time to get into Pet Sounds, but I love that when there's a journey and there's a challenge, and then you do get to this moment of clarity. It's like, Yeah. You know, the scales lifted from your eyes. Yeah. You're like, oh, God, yes, I see what they're doing now.
Pet Sounds only really clicked for me about 4 or 5 years ago, actually. I've always loved all the singles off it, but there was a moment where it suddenly all made sense, and now I'm almost like, almost scared of listening to that record because it affects me so like profoundly emotionally.
So do you think I should persist?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
But I've been persisting for probably 20 years.
What I would say, my advice would be to juggle up the running order and listen to it on sort of random a bit. Because I found it, obviously, God Only Knows is the greatest pop song ever written. I don't think many people would dispute that. But, you know, there's so much texture and...
The instrumentals. You know.
Yeah. I mean, if you listen to... this is a bit tangential, but the Fleet Foxes record that came out a couple of weeks ago, and Robin Pecknell talks about how his whole inspiration is basically based on this one kind of outtake, which is on YouTube, of Brian Wilson doing the guide vocal for Don't Talk, Put Your Head on My Shoulder. And that was the thing that made me sort of click with like how incredible... his layering and how natural his like harmony and stuff is. He's like second to none.
So that's the thing, because I had my dad's CD of Pet Sounds, like had maybe it was before the days of like massive box sets. It just had like 5 or 6 bonus tracks, and one of the bonus tracks was that vocal arrangement. And you're just like, fucking hell, it was incredible, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like stops you in the tracks, tears in the eyes, sort of thing.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Let's overdub that voice.
Okay. I'll persist.
And also, similarly with Trout Mask, if you do want to get into Trout Mask, I think the secret with Trout Mask... No, okay. but anyway, just muting... the secret with Trout Mask is, definitely... It's a surprisingly accessible album that's very top-heavy with difficult tracks.
Right.
So there's about 10 songs in there, which if you listen to them, you'd think, why does this album have a difficult reputation? Because you could get into those songs. They're really groovy and really funky and amazing and
So it's funny. Like when you meet someone who's got a difficult reputation, they're fine half of the time.
His heart's in the right place. Yeah.
Would you not recommend to back into it from something like Clear Spot?
I've tried that. I've enjoyed. I'm not. Is it Mirror Man? Is that one of them?
Yeah.
So I every time I put Trout Mask on, it feels like I'm being pranked.
But that's because it starts with probably the hardest song on it.
The day I admit that I like Trout Mask will be the day that everyone kind of goes, we knew we could fucking talk you into this bullshit.
Emperor's New Clothes, that's great. Oh god, maybe I've been pranked.
That's brilliant. So that was Josh Widdicombe, an embarrassment of riches in that episode. It was really, really fun. Really enjoyed that one.
Yeah, that was a great episode. We really covered a lot of ground. I really like... A lot of the episodes seem to focus on the 90s, which I guess makes sense because of our kind of demographic. But yeah, that was great. And so now you will have heard the Kate Bush reference. And it's on YouTube. We'll post a link to the Kate Bush clip, and you can see what you think. Is she coming up with that off the top of her head, or is she actually quoting the Charlie Higson character from The Far Show? Who can say? Kate, if you want to get in touch, do your own personal Beatles, please do. Kate@bush.com. That might be her email address.
Bush.com is not, I don't wouldn't recommend going surfing around for that. But she is a Beatles fan, isn't she? I think in her first band that was sort of quite punky, she did a cover of Come Together.
Oh, right, so okay.
Maybe she would like to come on and clear up this whole Fast Show nonsense. Yeah.
I'll tell you what I've been enjoying a lot recently is Ariel. And I don't know if you watched
The dishwasher powder.
Yeah, I actually am. That's a separate point, but I can recommend Ariel washing powder. Yeah.
Ariel feature colour.
But the Ariel album is great. I don't know if you saw Us, the Tom Hollander programme.
No, I didn't.
It's very, very good, actually. And they made fantastic use of the choral room from Ariel, which is an unbelievably beautiful song. So maybe we could put that in the playlist. One thing, I mean, I know we need to wrap this up, but you're excited about McCartney 3? We really should have mentioned this.
Yeah, we haven't really talked about that. We'll be back next week with slightly more time, so maybe we can, we'll get round to reading some of your emails and stuff, and there have been some great ones. So apologies, we just wanted to keep this episode nice and short. But I like the little tease that they put out, and it sounds like it's, you know, very McCartney one in style. I think we take what we can get these days.
Have you noticed how whenever he's photographed playing the guitar, he's smiling, and whenever he's photographed playing the bass, he's smiling, but whenever it's the drums, his mouth is that perfect O shape. Always the drums. Right.
He's probably concentrating a bit harder.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. It looks and sounds like he's having a lot of fun. And
yeah, I immediately thought of like Coming Up kind of vibe when I heard that little clip, McCartney 2 sort of thing. It's sort of got that loose, funky thing going on.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Coming Up is the best Talking Heads song that isn't by the Talking Heads.
I was going to say, where are you going with that one?
Yeah.
No, it looks like, I mean, it would be fun to just play all those instruments. And, you know, he's playing on the Elvis Presley double bass. And
really
that
nice
beautiful
50s
telly that he's got.
Yeah.
Looking forward to it. Yeah. It's a shame. I mean, usually the thing I'm most excited about when there's a new Paul McCartney record is that it goes hand in hand with a tour, which is obviously not going to be the case in this.
Do you think there will be some kind of miraculous thing where it's like, I reckon the vaccine will be announced like the day it comes out or something? There'll be this
the
kind
vaccines
of...
are going to go on tour covering McCartney 3. That would be good.
I mean, that would really cap off a pretty bad year with quite a positive spin at the end.
Yeah. And I think the best thing for me about this album is that in a lot of the sort of promotional materials, they've used the tagline "Made in Rockdown." And I can't help feeling that at some point he must have considered that for the title before someone that we all have to thank was like, how about McCartney 3?
That's good. And have you heard the 10 Tricks Point Never album?
No.
Oh, it's very good. No. That came out last week. I've been enjoying that this weekend. That was made in Rockdown, too.
No, sweet.
But it's a slightly different feel to McCartney 3, but it's brilliant. I think it's one of his best ones. And it's like listening to a very strange radio station on deeply unpleasant drugs. That's how I describe it. It's a very good album, though.
Like sounds intriguing. Perfect Lockdown 2 material.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, so we're all going to have a bit more time in our hands in November than we expected. So
yeah,
why not go back and listen to all the podcasts again?
Indeed. Well, I don't. Yeah, you do if you want.
You can if you're really bored. We'll be back next week with the final episode of this series with Benoit Pialard.
I'm really excited about this one. This is just, I mean, he's probably one of my favourite musicians who's working at the moment. So it's just really nice to chat to him. I mean, I suppose I was a bit gushing, but he's a brilliant experimental ambient artist, and he obviously as well has a Beatles backstory, as everyone does. So it was a lovely episode.
So we'll be back next Tuesday with that one. I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you did, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts and give us a nice 5-star rating. And if you write us a nice review, we'll try and read it out on the show if we can. If you want to get in touch, you can go to personalbeatles.com/contact or email me jack@homespunsounds.com and we'll read out the last of your personal Beatles stories in the intro to next week's episode. If you've enjoyed this series and you would like us to help us come back for more later in 2021, if we're all still alive, then you can go to personalbeatles.com/donate. We'll be back next week.
Cheers.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Hold up.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.